Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to season 10 of the Islamic History Podcast. This season, we are concluding our discussion on the Mughal Empire. This is episode 10-12, The Closing. So if you've listened to the last episode, that was 10-11, The Last Mughal, we have concluded the history of the Mughal Empire. I want to thank you for sticking with this fairly long and somewhat complex story. Hopefully you've been listening from the very beginning with Genghis Khan and the Mongols, but if you haven't, I strongly encourage you to go back and listen to that. So I want to use this episode to give my thoughts on the Mughal Empire and hopefully discuss what's going to be coming up for the Islamic History Podcast in the near future, inshallah. First, let's go over some of my key takeaways for the Mughal Empire, for this long saga that we've been through. Now, we started the Mughal Empire by first discussing the rise of the Mongols and Genghis Khan, as I alluded to earlier. And from there, we then went on to Timur the Lame and then his descendant, Babur, who was ultimately the founder of the Mughal Empire. We discussed the rise of the Mughals from the Battle of Panipat in April 1526. And from there, over the next couple of years, we went over the lives of all the great Mughal emperors, including Humayun, Akbar, Jahangir, Shah Jahan, and Aurangzeb. After Aurangzeb, we begin discussing the slow and long decline of the Mughal Empire, which to me really begins with Bahadur Shah, and I'll explain that in a moment, inshallah. After Bahadur Shah, that kind of sort of began the era of the Sayyid brothers, followed by everyone's favorite playboy emperor, Muhammad Shah Rangila. And then we really got into the painful decline when the Mughal Empire was just falling apart. This decline included Delhi getting sacked and plundered multiple times, and by the emperor, the Mughal emperor, whichever one it was, there's quite a few of them, but most of them were puppets. First, they were puppets of the Afghans, and then the Marathas, and finally, the British Empire, or the British themselves. And we finally concluded the story, of course, with the Sepoy Mutiny. I prefer to call it the Sepoy Rebellion, but whatever the case may be, the Sepoy Mutiny, Sepoy Rebellion, which ended with the British deposing Bahadur Shah Zafar, who was the last and final Mughal emperor, though by then he was not much more than, as the British called him, the King of Delhi. He was really only the King of Delhi, and even more accurately, really just the king of his palace. Now, I believe this is the first series where we covered the entire rise and fall of an empire. Even the Ottoman Empire, which I have discussed extensively over the years, I haven't discussed the entire Ottoman Empire from the beginning to the end. I have discussed the rise of the Ottoman Empire, particularly in, I believe, the series on the Bosnian War. We discussed the rise of the Ottoman Empire, and we discussed the fall of the Ottoman Empire. That was in, I believe, the series on World War I. And we've also covered the middle of the Ottoman Empire here and there in different stories, particularly in this one. Within the Mughal Empire existed in the same time frame that the Ottoman Empire existed, and there was some cross-reference between them, and we have mentioned that in this saga about the Mughal Empire, but I haven't discussed the Ottoman Empire from beginning to end straight through. And I, quite frankly, I'm not sure if I'm going to do that because I've already done the beginning and the end. So I don't know if there's much need to go through the whole thing. And besides, if the Mughal Empire took three seasons, imagine how long it would take to do the Ottoman Empire. Just imagine that. Now, we are discussing the Umayyad Khilafat, which is kind of an empire. I know people don't like to use the word empire for Khilafat or whatever, but it was an empire at the same time. But we haven't completed the Umayyad Khilafat, so we're still going through that process. We probably won't be able to complete it. Well, I'm going to talk about that in a moment. I don't want to get ahead of myself. But this is the first time where I went through a full empire from beginning to end. So I want to discuss a little bit more about why I believe the Mughal Empire declined. Another thing I want to discuss, though I probably won't have time, I also wanted to discuss how the British colonized India. The British didn't just come in and beat the Mughal Empire in a series of battles and then execute their emperor and take over and rename it to whatever they wanted to call it. That didn't happen. It was a long, slow process of the British, really the East India Company, working on behalf of the British in a way. But the East India Company basically took little spots here, there, slowly built their power up. So as the Mughals were declining, the British were growing until it got to the point where the Mughals needed the British more than the British needed the Mughals. And we saw how the British were able to slowly but completely take over Bengal over the years. Most empires tend to have a long, slow decline. They don't really just collapse all at once. Whether it's the Roman Empire, the Ottoman Empire, even the British Empire, very few empires fall from a sudden battle or a sudden event. The Umayyads were overthrown by the Abbasids. That might be an exception, though I'm still learning about that, so who knows how that may turn out. But in most cases, the empire goes through a long, slow decline before it finally just disappears, however that may be, usually by being beaten by a stronger rival. And of course, we have the Abbasids, who were destroyed by the Mongols when the Mongols invaded Baghdad. Even the Abbasids had gone through a long, slow decline long before the Mongols actually arrived. I've mentioned my frustration throughout this series that so many secular or Western scholars blame the decline of the Mughal Empire on Aurangzeb and his jizya. Now, I do agree that Aurangzeb deserves some blame for the fall of the Mughal Empire, really for the decline, not the fall, because it took almost 150 years for it to fall after he died. So really, the decline of the Mughal Empire, he does deserve some blame for that, but I don't believe the jizya contributed much, if at all, to the Mughal decline. In my opinion, after doing this series, after all the research and all the reading I've been doing, I believe four things happened, essentially one after the other, and they just compounded the problems, and that ultimately led to the decline of the Mughal Empire, and the decline of the Mughal Empire led to the fall of the Mughal Empire. First of all, the culture of fratricidal war within the Mughal Empire, that was a self-defeating aspect of that empire, of that dynasty. No nation, no state can survive with a civil war taking place every 10 to 20 years. If you're having civil wars every 10 to 20 years, your country, your nation, your state, your empire will eventually collapse. These weren't rebellions, these were civil wars where the nation or the empire pretty much tore itself apart and then put itself back together after somebody came out on top. So that's the backdrop to it all. That, I believe, was the worst problem of all with the Mughal Empire. If it wasn't for the fratricidal wars, the decline probably would have still happened, but it may have taken longer, or it may have not been as brutal as it was. Now, before we get to the four things that I believe contributed to the Mughal decline, one thing I want to suggest, or I guess it's too late to suggest it now, this is like, you know, a couple of hundred years later, but still, perhaps if one of the later emperors, such as Shah Jahan or Aurangzeb, if one of them probably should have established a policy of selecting their successor so that before they die, the emperor who's currently seated on the throne, as he starts to get up in age, of course, people die suddenly, so this can't always control that, but all of these guys lived out their natural lives. None of them, neither Shah Jahan, nor Jahangir, who was before him, nor Aurangzeb, none of them died in battle or died suddenly or unexpectedly. They all lived to be fairly old men. Once an emperor gets to a certain age, they should select their successor, whoever it's going to be, whichever one of their sons is their favorite or they believe is the most qualified, whatever the case may be, select that son, and then demand that all other princes and all other major nobles within the empire swear fealty or allegiance to this successor. And then the former emperor could either continue to rule just with it known that now this prince is going to be my successor, or he could just step back, especially as he gets older and his faculties begin to dwindle. The former emperor, he now becomes a former emperor, or he steps back, or he just maybe keeps just the title, but his son continues to run things. Similar to how, I know people have the problem with Saudi Arabia, with MBS, but similar to how Saudi Arabia is doing with Mohammed bin Salman. Everyone, he kind of portrays himself as the king, but he's not the king yet. His father is still officially the king of Saudi Arabia. He is the crown prince. Mohammed ibn Salman is the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, but he's pretty much running that country. Something similar to that. That would have been a much more useful manner, a much better way of maintaining the empire. Somebody, one of those later emperors, Shah Jahan or Aurangzeb, should have done what they could. And this is where I kind of blame Aurangzeb, because he lived the longest. He really should have done something to stop that culture of fratricidal war. All right, so now let's discuss the four things that I believe led to the decline of the Mughal Empire. Number one, Aurangzeb lived too long. Aurangzeb lived, I think he ruled for almost 50 years, and by the time he died, his successor, Bahadur Shah, was already in his 60s. He was already an old man by himself. That didn't help. So when Aurangzeb died, his successor didn't have time to really build up his own infrastructure and his own administration and stabilize the empire after the fratricidal war that led to his rise to power, that has led to Bahadur Shah's rise to power. And the second thing is related to the first thing. Bahadur Shah didn't live long enough. Aurangzeb lived too long. Bahadur Shah didn't live long enough. And of course, no one has control over these things. I'm just saying that these are things that contributed to the Mughal decline, what I believe contributed to the Mughal decline. So with Bahadur Shah dying 5 years after his father died, and with this culture of fratricidal war going on, this now led to two major civil wars within less than a decade. That's a recipe for disaster. So you have Aurangzeb living too long, Bahadur Shah living too short, I guess, or reigning too short, really. And with that chaos, that opened the doors for the Sayyid brothers. The Sayyid brothers, this is the third reason, the third thing that I believe led to the decline of the Mughal Empire. The Sayyid brothers took advantage of the chaos resulting from back-to-back civil wars within the empire. The Sayyid brothers took advantage of that, and they used it to put themselves in power. Yes, they had the puppet emperors on the throne, but they were the ones in power. They were the ones who control things, and the Sayyid brothers weren't interested in the betterment of the empire. They were only interested in maintaining their own power. So they would install an emperor and get rid of him just as quickly, so long as it kept them in power. And that helped to hollow out the Mughal administration, the Mughal bureaucracy, the administrative bureaucracy of the Mughal Empire. And the final thing, the fourth thing that I believe led to the decline of the Mughal Empire was that Rangila lived too long, similar to Aurangzeb, but at least Aurangzeb was an effective emperor. Rangila was not. The Sayyid brothers, as I mentioned, their corruption and their, I don't know how else to put it, selfishness, whatever, their corruption helped to, as I mentioned, hollow out the administrative bureaucracy of the Mughal Empire. Then even when they were gone, Rangila was so useless. And he was just so useless. There were no competent, sincere administrators to run the empire. You can have a useless emperor. Jahangir was a drug addict throughout most of his reign, a good chunk of his reign, but at least his wife was fairly competent. She was power hungry, but at least she was competent. Rangila didn't have that. And I blame part of that on the hollowing out of the bureaucracy by the Syed brothers. During their time in power, they killed, exiled, alienated various bureaucrats, administrators, nawabs, subadars within the Mughal Empire. They got rid of them, exiled them, whatever the case may be, and that helped. That didn't leave anyone to give Rangila good advice or to run the empire in a sincere manner. Yes, he had his grand vizier, but except for Nizam al-Mulk, the grand viziers for under Rangila were generally useless and corrupt themselves. Now, Nizam al-Mulk, as I mentioned, he was sincere from what I can see. He did try to give Rangila sound advice, but Rangila was corrupt himself, and he was surrounded by corrupt people, and they alienated Nizam al-Mulk, and he wound up going back to the Deccan. He was basically pushed out of the way. The ineffectiveness of Muhammad Shah Rangila allowed the Persians and the Afghans and the Marathas and the Rajputs and eventually the French and especially the British to snatch away pieces of the empire. So in my opinion, and Allah knows best, of course, and there are probably even more factors than what I'm mentioning, but in my opinion, the empire went into terminal decline with the Syed brothers and Rangila. The empire was still functioning and almost at full strength during the short reign of Bahadur Shah. That's why I don't accept that idea that Aurangzeb's jizya suddenly tore the empire apart. No, during Bahadur Shah's reign, Aurangzeb's son, his successor, the Mughal Empire was a functioning empire. Unfortunately, Bahadur Shah was too old and he just didn't reign long enough. And so things fell apart. All right, so enough of that. I think I've driven my point home with that, inshallah. I want to address three questions/comments from the audience that I have received over the years of working on the Mughal Empire. These questions/comments are fairly interesting, and I just want to address them because you may have had these same questions yourself. Who knows? Now, one YouTube listener commented on a video I created about Akbar the Great. He mentioned how Akbar the Great had killed thousands of Hindus. Now, based upon the username, it seems as if that person was probably Hindu. And based upon the vitriol in his comment, I can assume that he was almost certainly Hindu. First, we have to acknowledge that Akbar the Great started the practice of marrying Hindus. I'm not aware that Babur did, and definitely not Humayun. They marry Shiites, but not Hindus. Especially Humayun definitely married a Shia. But Akbar the Great, he was the one who started marrying Hindus, and he did this to forge alliances with Hindu empires and Hindu states, particularly the Rajputs. Not really empires, but the Rajputs, most certainly. He did it for that reason. And what I've seen, which is kind of surprising, was that Akbar the Great, his life, his reign, his administration, the whole thing, was often romanticized by Bollywood. For those who may not know, Bollywood is basically the Hollywood of India, the Hollywood of the subcontinent, but especially in India. Bollywood has romanticized Akbar's life. I found that there are several movies made about Akbar in the 40s and 50s and on into the 90s. They were still making movies about Akbar the Great, and many of them were often directed by Hindu filmmakers, Hindu directors. But I also noticed that more recently, within the past 15, 20 years or so, I started seeing a lot more Hindu nationalists becoming very critical of Akbar, often citing that he killed thousands of Hindus, like this commenter on the YouTube video that I put up. If you want to know the video, I believe it is, was Akbar the Great Muslim? Something like that. Was Akbar Muslim? I made a video about it discussing whether Akbar was Muslim. Go to the Islamic History Podcast YouTube channel. You'll see it there. Go into the comments. Hopefully you'll see it. You'll see that comment there as well. And I did respond to it. Now, this is definitely true. The commenter was correct. He was accurate. I presume it's a he. It could have been a she, but I presume it's a he. He could have been correct that Akbar He was correct. He was definitely correct that Akbar the Great was responsible for the deaths of thousands of Hindus, particularly at the fortress of Chittor, which he conquered. I forgot the year, but I know it's covered in episode 8-15. I can't remember the year right now. But there's a thing. Here's the thing. Akbar the Great and all these emperors, the good ones at least, they were conquerors. Akbar the Great, for all of his administrative feats, and he was a great administrator. We may not like his religious choices, but he was definitely a great administrator. Akbar the Great was a conqueror. That man went to war. He was fighting from like the age of 15, okay? He was a conqueror. He was a warrior, and he fought and killed thousands of Hindus, but he also fought and killed thousands of Muslims as well. Akbar fought the Afghans in Delhi. He fought the Afghans in Bengal. He waged this long war against the Deccans, and all of them were the Deccan kingdoms, that is, and all of those kingdoms were Muslim kingdoms. Akbar the Great killed thousands of people because he was a conqueror. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but he was a conqueror. So there is no, this idea that Akbar was particularly hateful towards Hindus is absolutely crazy, especially when we understand that this man was marrying Hindus and he was trying to mix Hinduism and Islam, trying to find some sort of balance. The man didn't hate Hindus. He was just a conqueror, and he will fight anyone who was in his way as far as getting what he wanted when he wanted to conquer something. Many Muslims died because of Akbar the Great. So I don't want to hear any of this stuff about, you know, Akbar was deliberately hateful towards Hindus. He was a conqueror, okay? If there were Buddhists there, he would have killed them too. If there was Christians there and they were in his way, he would have fought and killed them also if he could have. He was the emperor. He was a conqueror. That's what they did. I think I've answered that one sufficiently, inshallah. Speaking of Akbar, I saw a lot of back and forth over the years discussing the Mughal Empire regarding whether Akbar was Muslim or not. Now, we sort of addressed this in season 8, and the video I just mentioned does the same thing, just regurgitates the same thing that I said in season 8. But I've read lots of different things regarding Akbar and his take on religion and his attitude towards Islam. And the thing is that because Akbar didn't write these things himself, it's kind of difficult to understand exactly how he felt. The Akbar-nama does exist, that's Akbar's biography, but he didn't write it. His vizier wrote, but the Akbar-nama was not written by Akbar the Great. It was written by his best friend, his vizier, his advisor. It's hard to really tell what was Akbar's thoughts. We have to try to peer into his actions and get his thoughts. So some descriptions of Akbar portray him as what we would probably call today a very liberal Muslim. A very liberal Muslim who was open-minded about other faiths and was one of those all religions are the same kind of guys. Or one of those, as one famous da'i says, a compassionate imam. He may not have been a compassionate imam, but he was a compassionate emperor. He may have been something like that. Allah knows best. But others also portray him, and this particularly comes from more strict Muslims, I put it like that, often portray him as a murtad, someone who fully left Islam. My opinion is that, from what I've researched, and there's always more to learn. Who knows what else is out there to learn? Allah knows best. But from what I've researched, I definitely believe that he left Islam when he invented his own religion called Deen Ilahi. There's no doubt. You don't get to create your own religion and still be part of this one. So, yeah, he definitely left Islam when he invented Deen Ilahi. But I can also accept that he came back to Islam during his last days, especially since that's what his son and successor, that is Jahangir. Jahangir said that Akbar, his father, came back to Islam and pronounced Shahada before he died. Now, only Allah knows if this is true and if this was accepted, but I'm more inclined to believe that Akbar would have done something like that. I'm not saying he made a bedside conversion, because I'm not even sure that would be accepted or not, but I can believe that he probably would have done so. Again, Allah knows best. All right, so last question before we move on. This is a more recent one. Someone asked me in the Telegram group, in the Islamic History Podcast Telegram group, why didn't anyone try to overthrow Muhammad Shah Rangila? especially when they saw just how bad he was as an emperor. With a couple of things here. First of all, people didn't realize just how weak the empire was until Nadir Shah came and sacked Delhi. Before Nadir Shah came through, despite the corruption of the Sayyid brothers and Bengal and Awadh and Hyderabad breaking off from the empire, despite all that, the Mughal Empire had this aura of invincibility. They had defeated the Portuguese at a certain point in time. They had defeated the British at a certain point in time. They defeated most of their enemies over the years. So they had this aura of invincibility that they just couldn't be beat. But when Nadir Shah came through, and Persia was nothing close to what like Britain was, even in the 1600s or 1700s, I should say, Persia was behind Britain and France even then. But as far as militarily, I'm speaking, militarily powerful. But when they saw how easily and thoroughly Nadir Shah came and sacked not the outlying borders of the Mughal Empire, not some major city sitting between the Mughal Empire and the borders of the Persian Empire, not some far-flung vassal of the Mughal Empire. They went to the capital of the Mughal Empire, and just ran amok. They just laid waste to Delhi. Nadir Shah could have done whatever he wanted to do. He could have killed the emperor if he wanted to do that. And when people saw how completely Nadir Shah just humiliated and defeated the Mughal Empire with Rangila in charge, that opened the floodgates. Everyone started smacking the Mughals around after that. The Afghans came soon after them. Then the Marathas came through. And then, of course, came the big boys, the British, and they just smacked everybody around. People didn't overthrow the Mughal Empire because they still thought the Mughal Empire was a Mughal Empire of Aurangzeb's days. It wasn't, but that's what people thought. Another thing to understand is that there were several nobles who were still loyal to the empire, and they would have rushed to defend Rangila if anyone tried to overthrow him. Nizamul Mulk is an example. I believe also Sadat Khan, he was also an example, and maybe a little bit less so, but still. But Nizamul Mulk, if he knew that somebody was trying to overthrow the emperor, he would have rushed up from Hyderabad, rushed up from the Deccan to try to protect the emperor. Even though Rangila most certainly did not deserve that loyalty, Nizamul Mulk would have done that. Another thing is, there's a question of legitimacy. So you overthrow Rangila, you either have two options. Of the people who could have overthrown Rangila militarily, probably Nizamul Mulk may have had the military capability to do so. The Deccan was fairly well run during his reign. It kind of fell apart later on, but it was fairly well run during his lifetime. Had Nizamul Mulk, he was already very loyal, so there's no way he would have done this. But if Nizamul Mulk wanted to overthrow Rangila, he probably could have done so, except for the fact he would have to travel from the Deccan to Delhi. And there's no way to do that without alerting attention. And of course, Rangila and the others, those who supported him would have prepared for it. And it would have been a long, slow battle. And almost certainly, Nizamul Mulk would have been defeated before he got to Delhi, simply because just through attrition, trying to march from the Deccan to Delhi, they would have just wore him down. By the time he got to Delhi, his army would have been, you know, a shadow of his former self from the time it left the Deccan. So if Nizamul Mulk, however, was somehow able to sneak an entire army to Delhi's doorstep, I believe he could have overthrown Rangila militarily. But here's the problem. The question of legitimacy. So he overthrows Rangila. Nizamul Mulk has two options, or whoever overthrows Rangila, they got two options. Either they end the Mughal dynasty and start a new dynasty, place themselves on the throne and start a new dynasty. That's an option. We know how that's going to turn out from history. That's going to lead to a lot of competitors. Whoever that new emperor is, this new dynasty, they are going to have to, they will be fighting people off for the next 50 years, because everyone, once that door is open, everyone's going to try to step through it. there'll be so many more challengers after that. That's one option. But the most likely option would have been for Nizam al-Mulk or whoever overthrew Rangila to really play the role of the Sayyid brothers, become a kingmaker, drag some hapless prince out of the Mughal dungeons, place him on the throne, and tell him, do what I say, and rule through this new puppet emperor and do that. And, you know, we saw that worked out with the Sayyid brothers. Maybe Nizam al-Mulk or whoever might have been more sincere, but that leads to a bunch of problems too. So that's the only way that empire would have remained legitimate. Otherwise, if Nizam al-Mulk tried to place himself on the throne, he would have to deal with the legitimacy, and he would have faced a whole bunch of challenges. It would have been a never-ending fight. And besides, simply overthrowing Rangila might not have actually fixed things. It might not have been the thing to turn things around for the Mughal Empire. We see from the many rebellions today that we have witnessed over the past 10, 15, 20 years, Yemen, Libya, Lebanon, that's a little bit older, but still, Iraq, Iran. I mean, we've seen these things happen consistently throughout the Muslim world, where somebody is overthrown, and it just opens the door for all sorts of violence and corruption and just chaos, on and on and on and on and on. So sometimes it's better to maintain an incompetent emperor for stability's sake than to violently overthrow that emperor or ruler or whoever, whatever the case may be, and invite an even bigger problem. In most cases, it leads to an even bigger problem. And Allah knows best. We just talk alternate history here. Allah knows best. All right, so that's it for the questions. Now, I want to talk about what's going to happen next season, inshallah. Now, for the past 4 years, hopefully you're aware of this, maybe you're not, but I'm sure you are, I've been working on the Umayyad Caliphate, mostly on the premium channel, Islamic History Exclusive. That's the primary financing for this podcast. All the research, the equipment, the storage, all these things is mostly done through the subscribers who pay for the Islamic History Exclusive podcast, and where I cover stories that I don't cover in Islamic History podcast. Well, mostly we've been discussing the Umayyad Caliphate during this period. We just finished third season of the Umayyad Caliphate sometime last year. The Umayyad Khilafat is taking longer than I thought it would. But we need to bring this series of the Umayyad Khilafat, we need to bring it to a close. So inshallah, what I'm going to do over the next couple of seasons is alternate the remaining seasons of the Umayyad Caliphate between the paid channel, Islamic History Exclusive, and the free channel, which is this one, Islamic History Podcast. I estimate there's going to take about another 4 seasons, not 4 years, 4 seasons, to conclude the Umayyad Caliphate. So instead of doing 1 season a year, which is what I've been doing, basically 1 season a year, what I'm going to do is 2 seasons a year. 2 of these seasons will be on Islamic History Exclusive and only available to those who are subscribed to it, and it is a paid subscription, and 2 seasons on the Islamic History Podcast, which is, of course, free. So if you are subscribed to Islamic History Exclusive, you really don't have to do anything. You will hear all 4 seasons in full because you're going to get the free stuff and the paid stuff. If you're not subscribed to Islamic History Exclusive, then you will hear 2 seasons of the Umayyad Caliphate in full. And the other two, well, you're just going to have to get recaps for the other two. I will recap whatever we covered at the beginning of every season. If everything goes as planned, inshallah, almost immediately after you listen to this, I will begin preparing for season 4 of the Umayyad Khilafat, of the Umayyad Caliphate, which means that the next season of Islamic History Podcast, the free channel, coming out later this year, will be season 5 of the Umayyad Caliphate. Once we complete the Umayyads, and we're going to alternate like that until we finish the Umayyad Khilafat and we move on to the Abbasids. Once we conclude the Umayyads, we are going to start a new series on the Abbasids and also on Andalusia. Well, that will do it for season 10 of the Islamic History Podcast. I hope I haven't confused you. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. You've been listening to the Islamic History Podcast, and we hope you've enjoyed the show. You can support the Islamic History Podcast and get exclusive content by subscribing to our premium channel, Islamic History Exclusive. If you're an Apple or Spotify user, open the app and search for Islamic History Exclusive. If you're listening on Podbean, become a patron in the app and you'll get access to our premium content. You can also join by visiting patreon.com/Islamic History. I'd also like to thank Brother Zulfikar Sarosh for his research on the Mughal Empire and his continued support of the show. And thanks to all of our premium subscribers. Be sure to join the Islamic History Podcast Telegram group where you can download a copy of today's transcript. Finally, subscribe to the Islamic History Podcast YouTube channel for our video documentaries. Stay tuned for a short clip from the latest season of the Umayyad Caliphate. Until next time, my name is Muttaki Ismail for the Islamic History Podcast. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the Umayyad Caliphate Season 3, presented by Islamic History Exclusive. This season, we are discussing the years 96 through 105 AH. This is episode 3-12, A Dynasty in Turmoil. This is the final episode of this season. Let's begin by discussing Khalid al-Qasri. One of Hisham's first acts as caliph was to dismiss Ibn Hubayra as governor of Iraq and the eastern provinces. Ibn Hubayra was replaced with a man named Khalid al-Qasri. When Khalid al-Qasri became governor of Iraq, he attempted to arrest his predecessor, Ibn Hubayra. Ibn Hubayra fled and Khalid al-Qasri sent al-Harashi to hunt him down. Now remember, al-Harashi was the former governor of Khurasan who had been dismissed by Ibn Hubayra. Well, al-Harashi eventually finds Ibn Hubayra as he's attempting to flee across the Euphrates River. Now that he has him cornered, al-Harashi asks Ibn Hubayra what did he think was going to happen to him. Ibn Hubayra said he did not think his fellow tribesmen would hand him over to another tribe. Both of these men, Ibn Hubayra and al-Harashi, belonged to the Qais tribe. Al-Harashi said he was right and left him alone. However, al-Harashi was not so kind to Ma'qil ibn Urwa. As we discussed in the previous episode, Ma'qil ibn Urwa had been appointed as the governor of Herat in Afghanistan by Ibn Hubayra, the outgoing, the former governor of Iraq. Al-Harashi at the time was the governor of Khurasan, and Herat was part of Khurasan. Afghanistan was considered part of Khurasan. All of the eastern provinces were considered part of Khurasan. Well, al-Harashi was insulted by Ma'qil. We discussed the reason for al-Harashi to feel insulted in the previous episode. I encourage you to go back and listen to that. And as a result of this bad feeling, this feeling of being insulted, al-Harashi had Ma'qil ibn Urwa whipped with 200 lashes. Soon after that, however, Ibn Hubayra dismissed al-Harashi and then had him arrested. Despite being treated so poorly by al-Harashi, Ma'qil ibn Urwa intervened for him and he prevented Ibn Hubayra from torturing al-Harashi. Nonetheless, despite Ma'qil ibn Urwa extending this kindness to him, al-Harashi still held a grudge against Ma'qil ibn Urwa. He accused Ma'qil ibn Urwa of making false accusations against him. So now that a new governor of Iraq is in town, now that Khalid al-Qasri is the governor of Iraq, he goes through the same process as we've seen before. He dismissed all of the governors who had been appointed by Ibn Hubayra, which included Ma'qil ibn Urwa, and then he ordered al-Harashi to whip Ma'qil ibn Urwa. And al-Harashi was only too happy to do so. And as al-Harashi was whipping Ma'qil ibn Urwa, Ma'qil cursed him. Khalid al-Qasri heard about this and he ordered another whipping against him, but a qadi, that is a judge, intervened saying that he could not be beaten again. And so with this, we now come to the end of the year 105 AH And we have actually come to the end of most of our story for this season. We're going to spend the rest of this episode, inshallah, discussing what's coming in the next season. The next season of the Umayyad Caliphate will mark the beginning of the end of the Jihad state. Hisham ibn Abdul Malik was the last caliph to rule over the Jihad state. Now, what is the Jihad state? Now, I'm borrowing this term from the author Khalid Yahya Blankenship. This is a term that Khalid Yahya Blankenship used to describe the early years of the Ummah. From the time of Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu until Hisham ibn Abdul Malik, the caliphate, the khilafat, the Muslim Ummah was in a state of constant warfare. It was constantly expanding, and this expansion was being done mostly through warfare. And this warfare was jihad against neighboring states. Now, we're not going to talk about whether the jihad was justified now. Understand, most nations did this. So I don't really feel the need to try to come up with some sort of justification. Most great empires of the past, even up until recent history, used warfare and violence to expand their borders. That's what empires do. We've already discussed the difference between expanding the borders of the empire through warfare and expanding the religion of Islam through warfare. The second was rarely, if ever, done. The former, expanding the borders of the empire, that was done very often. And quite frankly, most other nations, pretty much any other great nation, used violence to expand its borders.